Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, Dan Nadel, author and curator at New York's Whitney Museum of American Art, talks about his latest book, Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. Published by Scribner in April of this year, this book examines the life of celebrated artist Robert Crumb. Bio member Brian J. Jones interviewed Dan Nadel via Zoom this past July.
So Dan, how you doing?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm so happy to be talking with you. I remember we had a conversation about this bio a couple of years ago at the conference. And I was like, no way, you got him. So congratulations.
Yeah,
it's great. Let me give you the Brian Lamb question first here, just for our listeners who may not know. Tell us a little bit about who is R. Crumb and what would readers who've never heard him maybe know him for?
Robert Crumb is the sort of founding father of underground comics. He came to prominence in the 1960s and really made comics into a medium for any kind of self-expression. So everything from autobiography to social critique to sex and really trenchant critique of just American society, and using any kind of language or imagery he desired. He came to be known for his unfiltered aesthetic. And people might know him from the Cheap Thrills record cover, Janis Joplin's famous Cheap Thrills record. They might know him from Keep on Truckin', the image of the guys sort of kicked back, legs splayed out, walking down the avenue. Or they might know him from some of his characters like Mr. Natural or Fritz the Cat. So he's, broke through in the 60s and really helped kind of create a lingua franca for counterculture, but then kept right on going, making incredible work in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, including a full-length adaptation of the Book of Genesis, which was a wildly successful graphic novel in 2009. And he remains drawing comics today. He's become an elder statesman of what we now think of as the entire graphic novel boom of Mouse and Persepolis and Fun Home. All these books that wouldn't exist without his example.
It's funny, my high school here in New Mexico was founded, I think, in 1970. So our mascot was officially the Truckin' Eagle. It was this eagle that was like walking in the truck.
And I didn't know that.
They've changed it now where it's more, they call it the Golden Eagle, but you still look at the drawings of it, it's still a Truckin' Eagle is on the walls at our high school.
That is funny. Wow.
So when I talked to you at the BioConference a couple of years ago and you had mentioned the project, and I think my mouth dropped open when you told me you had Crumb participating. How did that happen?
So I wrote Robert in, spring of 2018 and pitched this. And basically my pitch was I really wanted to place him in the context of comics history, yes, but also just American visual culture. And that I felt like the brilliant movie that Terry Zwigoff made in the early 90s had done a deep dive into the kind of carnivalesque nature of his life. But that my interest was, yes, his life, but also its place in the context of other American lives and, how his work really fits into art history. And that was enormously appealing to him. He knew someone would write a biography. I mean, Robert is incredibly self-aware and aware of his legacy and comics histories and history in general, how it's made, how it's constructed. And he really wanted somebody who understood comics to do that biography. He didn't want to have to explain it, and he wanted to make sure it was done right. So, ultimately, that was what won him over, was this, I'd done a lot of work in comics and about comics over the years, and he was just relieved he wouldn't have to explain Little Lulu to someone. And, that was appealing, and also that he imposed one condition, which was that I just be honest and forthcoming about the charges of racism and misogyny in his work. So I was happy to take that on as well. You know, I think it's important to have a full picture.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that fact because I mean you really did a warts and all with him without writing a takedown.
Right.
I mean it's brutally honest, which Crumb's work itself also is. Was there any time either you or Crumb were like, "Oof, I really wish you wouldn't," or was there any time where you thought, "No, that's too much"? You do talk about in the collection that you edited of some of his work that some of that stuff in there is just oof. And there's even I think even one cartoon you're like, "We're not going to put that one in here." But did you
Right.
run into that on the bio itself, where you're like, "Ooh, that's going to be a bridge too far"?
No. There were things that I did not put in that would be harmful to people who are still alive. Nothing that Robert himself did, but things that happened with characters in the book. And so I left that out because it didn't advance the narrative either. It didn't really, wasn't germane. But no, I felt like if it was part of Robert's story, it needed to be in. And part of the story I'm telling here is somebody who survived a huge amount of difficulties, both imposed upon him and self-imposed. And to sort of shy away from that would be a mistake. And also because Robert is so open that eventually it would have come out, whatever it was. So anything less than real transparency and honesty would have sort of taken away from the biography and ultimately been a real detriment to it. So no, he never asked me to tame anything down, amazingly. And I didn't either. I mean, you know, there were stories that I left out of that compilation because I really wanted to make a case for reading Crumb now. And I felt like including things that would make people turn off would be counterproductive to that book, and also because those stories are available elsewhere.
Yeah, I think people who are listening should know your book. For the most part, anytime you mention a panel or a strip, you've put it in there for them. So, like, because you're literate in comics, you do a great job in the book, I think, of describing the comic itself, but it's really helpful. You'll turn the page and then there it actually is. So
Oh, thanks.
I think the book's very smartly laid out in that regard.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to really pace it so that, you know, you wouldn't be left having to flip to the middle to a color section, or, you know, I wanted it to really work. And that was also thanks to David Michaelis did a great Charles Schulz biography that interspersed examples all the way through, and I looked at that really closely.
Yeah, that was an example I thought of because Michaelis in that book, I thought at times when I was reading it, oh, I don't know that I buy this. You know, he was talking about it, the perils, and you'd go read the strip the next page and go, oh, yeah, well, I do buy that. So, anyway,
Yeah.
it's a well laid out book. I was really,
Brilliant
it's great
book.
that your book always had the panel you were talking about. I didn't have to try to
Thanks.
visualize it. Crumb's own taste in pop culture are so interesting. Did you immerse yourself in, that old timey music of his? And did you go watch the Cheap Suit Serenaders? And how much did you delve into that sort of old timey 78s world of his?
Quite a bit. I mean, you know, I spent a good amount of time with Robert in France, and one of the great experiences of the project was getting to sit with him and listen to his records. So he would DJ for a couple hours at a time and tell me the stories of the records, and it was fabulous. It was just really transporting. And so yeah, I did listen to a lot of music, some of which I'd listened to before. I mean, I've been into Crumb for a long time, and also at various points in my life been really interested in 78s. And I tried to read some of his enormous brain library and listen to a lot of that music and go back. And, you know, I learned a good amount about Thomas Nast, and I needed to sort of bring that texture into the book.
I was going to ask, how did understanding that help you understand him?
You know, it's the case with understanding any artist's influences. You sort of triangulate. And in the case of the music, he said something really interesting to me once. He was being sort of aw shucks about his own work. And I said, well, Robert, why don't we, you know, cut the shit? Like, you're a fiercely competitive artist and you foregrounded yourself and, you know, been very competitive with artists for whatever, 60 years, you know, you're one of the greats. And he said, yeah, well, sure. But, and he pulled out a 78 and he was like, this record is one of the all-time great records but this artist never recorded another song. So what does it really mean when you say I'm one of the greats? So like the sort of regional aspect of the music, the one-off, lightning in a bottle aspect of it, the sort of moment of inspiration that then passes, and also just the fact that the guy, Robert, did a lot of covers, he did a lot of portraits, he did a lot of comics about old music. So understanding all of that kind of helped me understand the appeal of it to him because I really enjoyed it, the music. But also, there's something about the obviously analog nature of it, the anachronistic nature of it, that dovetails perfectly with the idea of drawing comics, which in itself is the way he does it and the way some of the best cartoonists working today do it. Fiercely analog. It is ink on paper. And that is a callback in a way to that old music. And there's something about the way Robert tells stories that has the same kind of Robert speaks and tells stories in a kind of rhythmic mode. And his anecdotes have the kind of sometimes the stuff of sudden meaning that those songs do. Being sort of bopping along, telling you a story, and it'll come up short with a change or a reversal that feels very much like a song.
Yeah. So you said he understood his place in comics history, which I'm, as a comics fan, I'm glad to hear. I was so fascinated throughout the story of the issue of money with him because he's so successful, he's so famous, and he never really seems to have two nickels to rub together. He's sort of feast and famine, feast and famine. He doesn't usually seem to care. He's still working almost constantly. When things get rough, he bolts. Where does that drive in him come from? I mean, the man's just, he's constantly in motion, it seems like.
I think it probably started from two impulses that are probably maybe the same impulse. He wanted to get away from his family, from his misery. So there was always an urge to find an escape hatch. And, by the time he's a teenager or so, late teens, he intuits that he must follow his talent, that he'll be miserable if he compromises his talent. And by the time he sees his heroes and then the people he worked alongside, heroes like Harvey Kurtzman, sort of chase money and fail, in essence, get stuck doing, in Harvey Kurtzman's case, Harvey Kurtzman, who created Mad Magazine and was Robert's mentor and friend and hero. Kurtzman created all this unbelievably great culture. And then was trapped doing work for Playboy for most of his adult life because he needed the paycheck. The greeting card company always were deferring their dreams because they needed the paycheck. Robert really resolved that would not be him. Also, the thing about him that goes unremarked on often is that he is not the charming naif that he presents. I mean, he is very charming, but Robert's always been able to find a way. So yes, he'll drop everything and run. But down the line, he'll sell a sketchbook to make it work, or he'll draw some advertisements and trade for food, whatever. He's always been able to do that, and it's kind of a testament to the power of his communicative abilities, like the artwork somehow zaps people in just the right way. So money was never a big concern. No, I mean, he'd rather have records, women, and comics. But that said, by the 90s, when he's in his, you have to remember, like, he started so young and he never had any of the life lessons that a lot of other people get. I mean, he never learned a thing about managing finances or just had any kind of example from his parents. He didn't go to college. So there's no, he never really had an example of how to do that. But, by the time he hits middle age, he's getting a lot more responsible. So, he's selling sketchbooks for enough money to buy a house in France. He, in the last 25 years, has been financially comfortable. So, Robert's 82. So, since I would say he was about 50, he's been pretty financially secure, if not before that, and more responsible than one would think.
I was saddened the story of his son, which I had not heard all that. His son shows up in the Zwigoff documentary, but we don't get the rest of that story in there. Talk about a little bit as a husband and as a father. I mean, it's like Aileen really straightens his crap out eventually when she comes into his life. But talk about a little bit as a husband and as a father, and especially someone who has the sort of proclivities that he has.
It's always so funny talking about a living subject and as a husband and a father. Robert, like a lot of people that have children, wasn't ready to have a child and resented having a child initially in 1968 with his son Jesse, and carried that resentment for a long time. Robert is also somebody who cannot force himself to do things that he deep in his consciousness doesn't want to do. Some people can, I can, maybe you can. That's not who he is. And you take that out of the equation and maybe other things fall apart too. I don't know. So with Jesse, Jesse never stood a chance. Jesse inherited depression and anxiety from both sides of his family and was raised in chaos. And Robert couldn't really deal with that. And Jesse just, had drug problems throughout his life and passed away when he was 50. And Robert just wasn't equipped. When Sophie was born, Robert was already almost 40 years old and more equipped and calmer and able to attend to her in a way that he just wasn't able to 13 years before that with Jesse.
Yeah, the Zwigoff in the Zwigoff document, he can't stop kissing her when she's sitting there drawing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this sort of overcompensating comes with its own psychological and emotional issues. That sort of almost overattention, which I talk about in the book a little bit. And as a husband, as Aileen said, they were sort of the meeting of the minds. They did a lot for each other. I think he offered a certain amount of excitement, but also a certain amount of peace for her, and vice versa. They are two people who really needed to find one another. They kind of fit together in a very interesting way. And yes, Aileen, by temperament, was a much more no-nonsense person who could look at a stack of bills, let's say, or look at something and know that you needed to get under the hood and fix it. Robert would look at the stack and just throw up his hands. And she had that kind of example, though her own upbringing was very chaotic. At least there was sort of a sense of how things work into her life.
I think it was the two of them. It's an example of what do they say? Game recognizes game. I mean,
Yeah.
these two incredibly talented people both have sort of chaotic lives, but
Yeah.
really, like, kind of needed each other. I thought
I
it
think
was
that's true.
a fascinating relationship, especially compared with his first marriage.
Yes. Totally different kind of situation. I mean, his first marriage was, it was not was a meeting of two people who needed to find each other to escape from their families, but then had no idea what to do with each other.
So for comic nerds like me, and you've talked a little bit about one of the people I wanted to ask you about, the book is full of just so many cool cameos. I mean, you get Harvey Kurtzman, you get Art Spiegelman, you get Spain. One of the things I loved about writing about well-known people is every chapter you're like, oh, great, I get to write this particular character in this chapter. And they often say, don't meet your heroes. And a lot of your heroes in this case are still living, some are not. Tell me about writing, when you get to that chapter, are you just like, can't wait to get your hands on Harvey Kurtzman or can't wait to get your hands on Art Spiegelman? Like how fun is it to like make those sort of characters, as we call them, come alive on the page as a biographer?
That's a great question. Fun. Nerve-wracking when they're still alive or when they're friends like Spiegelman. And in my case, harder when they were still alive because it's hard to see the 50 years before version of them and to kind of tease that out. But I've been lucky. I've met a lot of my heroes and never been disappointed. Interviewing Spiegelman or Bill Griffith or Justin Green, or Aileen or Diane Newman about Robert Never Disappointed, because they were always these sort of funny, insightful interviews. It was a total joy to bring to life somebody like Karl Barks, and also painful because I had to cut out so much about him that I'd learned and put into words. I loved bringing to life the cartoonists of the 40s and 50s more than almost anybody else, and Kurtzman. I loved working on and writing about Kurtzman, is somebody I would like to do more on. Especially because, when you write about some of these people who haven't been written about in a kind of thoroughgoing, non-fan-centric manner, in a kind of more standard nonfiction culture mode, you realize how much texture has been left out, and how you don't really know that, like, Barks is bringing a kind of working class dark sensibility to Disney, or you don't think about, what the process was for John Stanley to sort of sketch out and write Little Lulu, and went to the artist, and then it went, these things that just don't get talked about that much, or how enormously popular these things that now we think of as almost like modernist masterpieces, like Karl Barks's Donald Duck or Stanley's Little Lulu. How enormously popular they were, and how difficult it is to communicate that these enormously popular things were also rich, rich, meaningful texts. They were influential on people like Crumb or Spain or S.K. Wilson, who used them in totally debauched ways, and not to, I should say, use the lessons they learned from these sort of wholesome texts to invert and send up American culture. Like, that's enormously enjoyable to dig into these people so that you can really understand what it is they did and what lessons they inadvertently imparted onto this generation of much more rebellious cartoonists.
Well, I'm glad it was you who got to do the serious bio of Crumb.
Thank you.
I encourage everyone to read this. Like I said, you won't get lost because he's got all the graphics in there, so you can follow along if you're playing the home version of the game. The panel that Dan refers to in any moment you will find reproduced in the book. You also have a great companion bio guide to this with some of his more recent work, which is a lot of fun too. So I can't thank you enough, Dan. This has been fascinating. I wish we could talk another half hour and talk comics
Me
anytime.
too. Thanks,
Thank you very
Brian.
much, Dan, for
Happy
talking.
to be here. Thank you.
That was author and Whitney Museum curator Dan Nadel speaking with bio member Brian J. Jones about his latest book, Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. It was published by Scribner in April 2025, and this interview was recorded in July of this year via Zoom. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.